My condition was ill.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Ricardo on the board after a bout with the Kennedy Expressway and a truck. Did you run that truck into the wall?
No, I did not. But yeah, it was kind of a mess back there, man.
Kind of a mess back there. Yeah, that's what they were talking. Did you have to get off the expressway? Or you get on the.
I had to get off, man. Yeah. Yeah. It was like a half an hour in the city.
Well, it's a nice city, you know.
Oh yeah, it's not. I mean, you know, I just wish I wasn't so late, you know.
Well, a couple minutes. We have Mr. Carl.
Yeah, we do.
You do.
Carl, I understand you're pounding the table, like what's his name, the little economist from Wharton who's always wrong. The Fed and your buddy Goolsbee, who's now the Chicago Fed guy. The Fed will save the market.
Oh, good God!
Yeah. You realize on March 17th, 2022, this is
just so you know, you have had the buying opportunity of a lifetime yesterday. Nvidia, instead of being 80 or 100 times earnings and 40 times sales, was only 37.
Right.
So that's the buying opportunity of a lifetime, I tell you. And there, what I think people should take from this, all right, so obviously, if you woke up yesterday morning and you took a look at the futures, you said, oh my God.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially after two down days.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's, by the way, that is a crash pattern.
Yep.
Okay. Anybody who's paid any attention to the market for any length of time knows that that is a crash pattern. It really is. What got me to start writing the market ticker was a very similar thing in the early part of 2007 that initiated in Asia, actually in the Chinese market as well, okay, just like this one initiated in the Nikkei, and got me to start looking at, okay, what the blankety blank is going on here that, maybe I ought to be paying attention to instead of just buying the S&P and the NASDAQ and sitting on my hands.
like everybody else.
Like everybody else was doing, right? I mean, and I was, I was not doing poorly doing that either. And that's when I started digging into it, I found all the nonsense that was going on in the banking system and the, the mortgages and all of this. Well, you got a warning yesterday. Okay, now, of course, this morning, the spoofs are up substantially, and they were up even more overnight.
They're up a lot more. They're actually up about a third of what they were down. Maybe not even that.
Yeah, I mean, we traded 5,300 last night. So, and now, we're 35 points under that. So, yeah, I mean, they were up a lot.
Yep.
But the thing is that... So, in the labor report, which, we like to go over on Jobs Friday, right? And we did it Friday. There is a hidden message in there that's been in there for the last 25, 30 years. And I've been personally tracking it with a spreadsheet because the BLS likes to go, just By the way, the Fed does this too with the Z1, which is why I stopped tracking the Z1, because I hadn't been keeping all of the old ones in my own copy.
All right, what's
E1?
Z1. Z1. What's Z1?
Z1 is the flow of funds numbers. Okay, so it is basically all of the flow of money that and credit, of course, that happens within the economy in different places. It is, if they would stop playing with it and reclassifying it, and for quite a long time, it was very stable. And then they started screwing around with it. When Obama did the thing with student loans in particular, they moved a bunch of things. But the problem was they did it retroactively. So they changed the historical data, which you're never supposed to do. Okay.
They've been doing that a lot lately.
Well,
it's almost at a point where they only want certain people to get the numbers.
Well, and the problem is if you don't keep your own private copies, then when they do something like that to you and then you try to go back and reanalyze something, you get a totally different result, okay? Which is, I mean, how do you square that with what you had before, right? You can't. So, you know, I mean, it's like, oh, well, in history, that really didn't happen. You know, this battle wasn't won by this particular combatant. It was won by somebody else. No, it wasn't. That did happen. We can argue over something later, but not what occurred. So I gave up on the Z1. But the BLS has not done this in a way that tampers with this piece of information. So in 2000, we had a non-institutional working population, as we do today. And we had the number of people who got added to that over the previous 12 months. Now, as I've talked about a few times before on the show, you can only use the January numbers because the non-institutional population is a guess for the other 11 months. In January, they rebase it to the ACS, which is that if you ever get one of those, that's the census thing that is like 40 pages long.
one of those like 2 or 3 years ago, and I actually filled it out. It was long.
Yeah, it's the most intrusive survey you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah,
I mean, the things they ask in there are crazy. But that's where the non-institutional population numbers and things like that come from. Okay, and it's only
they actually, if you don't send it in, they keep sending it to you and keep giving you crap if you don't.
Well,
they absolutely try and get you to fill it out. They're intending to be a random survey. They want you to answer it.
Oh, they'll threaten you with arrest.
Yeah, I'm saying they want you to answer
do it.
Yeah, but that's not the one where if you're not home, they go to the guy next door and ask him. It's not a random survey. They're actually trying to do a random survey with this thing.
Yeah, I mean they get really aggressive if you duck them. But the thing is that so January though is the only number. That number every January is corrected for the ACS. And then the other 11 months. So if you look at, if you graph this, there's a sawtooth profile to it, which is really weird. But it drifts over the other 11 months. And then in January, it gets corrected. So, but in January 2000, over the previous 12 months, we had added 2.2% of the workforce. Now, remember, non-institutional population is 16 plus, right?
Right.
So from the time you're born, it takes 16 years until it shows up. So if you and your wife or girlfriend decide to make a child, it is 17 years from the time you decide to make the child and successfully start making the
child. Or if you don't realize what you're doing actually could result in a child.
The hard way. You missed your period, right?
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? Your belly's getting bigger. You got a basketball in there. Yes, so it's 17 years from the time that you commit the act that creates a child until that child ends up in the non-institutional population. So there's a 17-year lag. And that's unavoidable. There's nothing you can do about it. All right.
By the way, it used to be 14, correct?
Yeah, it was. You went into the list at 14, but that was a long time ago they changed
it. Roosevelt changed it. That's how he pulled 2 years of people out of the labor force. That's how he got wages to go up.
Right. So you had the non-institutional population. So it was 2.2% was the rate of change in 2000 to the positive. This last January, it was 0.59. Now, it is dropping. And by the way, if you just take the Januaries and you graph it, it's a straight line down.
When do here's a question. This is
well, it will Chief. It will inevitably go negative sometime in the next 10 years.
Okay, my question is, and this is not a political stunt one way or the other. If somebody emigrates here, when do they get counted? When they get a Social Security card? When they become a citizen? When they get a Gemini? How does somebody get in that pile, that stack of people?
Well, when they're considered part of the non-institutional working population, which I assume would mean they would have to be a legitimate member of the workforce.
All right, so you have to have some kind of visa or something.
I would assume that at the point that you are legitimately considered a part of the workforce, that you would be in that list.
Okay. Yeah, but I don't know I guess I don't know what the trigger point for that is.
Well, if you're paying employment taxes.
Well, again, I'm not. I don't want this to turn into an immigrant discussion, but the dudes that are here in Chicago that are, you know, people are grabbing them at Home Depot and they're doing stuff at home and paying them cash, they're not in that list. I don't imagine, unless they have a legitimate visa.
I highly doubt they are, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know either.
Maybe now, what I will say is this: if you read the BLS report, you actually read all the descriptive text that they have in there, they claim that they try to account for illegal immigrants.
Okay, I mean, because that's
I don't know how you do that.
Well, you and I talked a million times about when you even the people employed, if it's hiring citizens to be carpenters, because we and I are building three houses all of a sudden and we're paying them $10.99. It's actually really tough for the government to figure out those guys are working until they get to $10.99 at the end of the year, right?
Well, yeah, and I mean, and as I, you know, there's slop in this, but if you read the descriptive text, the BLS claims that those people who are not here legally are in the data. Now, I don't know if I believe that or not, but this is what they're saying.
Well, even okay? If they are, how do they know about them?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, what somebody says they're doing and what they can actually accomplish sometimes are two different things, especially when the government's involved.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, I mean, but this is the reality of it is that this number is going to go negative within the next 10 years on the slope that it's on. And by the way, even if we changed things today, we couldn't do anything about that because it takes 17 years to fix it. Okay, from the time that you make the change, it'll be 17 years before that shows up in the data, just because of the fact that until you turn 16, you're not counted. So if you had a huge baby boom tomorrow as a result of a change in our policies, that's how long it would take. Now, here's the thing. We've talked about the debt, right? It shows up every now and then. The media actually has a discussion about this. Not very often.
Not very often, no. And when they do, it's usually a bunch of BS. But
right. But now here's, think about this. You're 20 years old. You have a girlfriend, boyfriend, depending on which sex you are or whatever. And
you're not part of the progressive movement now, obviously.
Well, you know, all right. Yeah. You know, you've got whatever rainbow color thing is going on. Point being, you have the appropriate equipment between the two of you to make children. And you're thinking about, okay, you know, let's live together. Maybe we get married, maybe we don't, whatever. But you know, we could do this, right? The higher your intelligence, the smarter that the two of you are, the more likely it is that you're going to conclude that with $35 trillion in debt, that baby who has benefited from exactly zero of that $35 trillion, because baby doesn't exist yet, therefore can't have benefited from it, is a slave.
What do you mean? He or she's be able to drive over the bridge you just made.
Yeah, except that bridge, what kind of condition is it in, and did you just make it?
Well, I mean, the Golden Gate's in good shape. We actually take care of that one.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, how about the Chicago Skyway?
It's all right now that we're paying $9 in tolls, all right?
Well, that was exactly my point.
Yeah.
Okay, you're paying $9 in tolls for it. The $35 trillion didn't have all that much to do with the...
No.
Okay, right. So,
well, the genius of building a free expressway 2 miles from a toll bridge, somehow or another, the genius missed me there. How that thing, which is part of the interstate system now, didn't get the same benefits as the Dan Ryan did, I don't know how the hell it all worked. But
yeah, all I'm pointing out is that if you objectively look at this and you say, okay, if this debt is ever going to be paid, all right, the person who is going to be expected to pay it didn't exist when it was incurred, therefore didn't get the benefit from it. The people who are here now got the benefit from it and blew the money.
Well, okay. You could make the argument that the reason why you're here in a free place is because we spent money in World War II or something. I mean, you could.
Well, okay, you could make that argument. However, what was the debt in World War II?
It was pretty much all paid by now, but you can
Okay. Point being, Chief, what is the trajectory on the debt, and how? And by the way, at what point did essentially all of it get incurred? All the $35 trillion get incurred?
Well, I'm not a new style economist. Certainly not a new monetarist. I'm a curmudgeon monetarist, but you certainly could make the claim that debt is going to be part of government the whole time, right? And as long as your growth, your real growth, and you're not lying to yourself and you're not BSing yourself with every bill that comes through, if your growth is growing faster than the debt, you probably don't have a problem. But when's the last time that happened?
Well, right, but that's not what's happening.
No.
And it's not what's been happening. Okay.
Well, because we lie about the growth, we lie about everything. So nobody wants a good number. What is it? Never let the facts get in the way of a good story. I mean,
well, exactly. But so here's the thing. So if you look at this now, remember, approximately the late 1960s and forward. So about 1970-ish, technology developed to the point that unless you want to have children, it's very easy to not have them yet have all the fun you want. All right. I mean, various forms of birth control.
When I was in high school and you first heard about that, the thought of having 40% of the people being born out of wedlock never even crossed anybody's mind. You thought everybody would control everything, and yet it's worse.
Well, yeah, okay, now, here's the problem with it. The skew is the people who think about it and say, I'm going to give birth to a slave, literally. And then they say, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not doing that. I don't care what you say to me. I'm not doing that.
Not to mention, it's like $1 million put a kid through school and
so there's a personal aspect to it, too, right?
Plus, you get to deal with a pain-in-the-ass teenager.
Well, been there, know that. But the thing is that, so you think about that. So the more you think, the more likely it is that that's going to be your conclusion. I'm not doing that. Not because I'm a self-absorbed narcissist, but because I'm not going to screw that child. I'm not doing that. All right? And so you don't. And so who makes all the children? Well, people who have approximately the intellectual firepower of your dog. Because they don't care about such things, they pay no attention to that at all. All they care about is, we have the correct equipment, let's have it, just like the rabbits in my backyard.
Or we're going to get a check.
Or we're going to get paid. Okay, right. So, I mean, that's logical, right? So, so that's what you end up with. But when you look at the data, if you take, the people who you need to have, I mean, look, you don't want Homer Simpson running the nuclear power plant, all right? That could be very, very bad. And if you look at the data, what the data says is that the people who you want to have creating the next generation have said, you've boned me enough times, I'm not playing your game anymore, have a nice day, it's not happening. And by the way, you can't stuff that technological genie back in the bottle. So the fact that I happen to be attracted to somebody, regardless of whether I'm homosexual, heterosexual, whatever, and decide to be with that person, does not necessarily mean that children will result.
We'll take a look at Japan. Hey, we got to dash you real quick. My original number that was lobbed out is as we are pushing for this all-saving rate cut, just be advised, this is just a fact. This is not, I'm not trying to go against Jeremy Siegel or any of these other geniuses, but we started raising rates on March 17, 2022, we being the federal government. So here we are 2.5 years later, and we're now at 5.5, which I agree is a little high, since the market's actually down to 5.1 or 5. We are up 25 or 30%. So if you look at that history, it's kind of hard to say all we need to do is cut once and the market will. One would think that since we were raising the rates the way the banter is going, that the market is in a hole. Yet it's not. It's way up.
So, well, not only that, but if you look at yesterday, the IRX was actually up a little bit.
Yeah, well, boy,
13-week bill on the day was actually up a little.
All right, when we come back, we have to talk about two things. One is, three things. One is the VIX move yesterday. Yikes. One is the Google antitrust. And The third is, I don't know if you've seen it, but they're actually going to try and restart the nuclear plant over in Michigan and have a couple of those little ones you're talking about on the same grounds. I don't know if you saw that or not. So you would be my
expert. That would actually be relatively speaking, compared to solar paneling the world. That's actually fairly intelligent.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you knew anything about that particular plant, the one in Coloma.
Yeah, Coloma. Yeah.
Anyway, S&P futures up 54, Nasdaq futures up 222. Be right back, Mr. Joel and Kenna.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I am also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well, we're back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamara Ricardo on the board. S&P futures up 47. Nasdaq futures up 193. Sounds like a good day, but it is so far. But after yesterday, we're not exactly getting back what we lost. Dow futures are up 273. Winner in there is that Caterpillar, which I believe had earnings. They might have had earnings. I think they did. They're up 1380, 330.60, up 4%. Over in Europe, now these guys were down yesterday. They're not doing much today. DAX up 14, 17,353. The FTSE down 4, call that flat. CAC down 17.2. The headline is European stocks nudge higher after Monday's market rout. The headline must be from an hour or two ago because they're not up anymore. They're not down, but they're not up. Nikkei up 3,200. It's 10%. Now they were down 12 yesterday. Okay, so Hang Seng is actually down 51.3%. 16,647. Shanghai up 6. Let's call that one flat, but still under 2,900. 2,867. So no big bounce there except for Japan, which is where this all started. We're also going to talk to Joel a little bit about how the yen got awful lot stronger yesterday. Let's see what the yen's doing here in a minute. Yesterday, again, we were down 1,000 points in the Dow, 160 in the S&P, and now we're up 47, so it's not even a third back. NASDAQ was down 576, and now it's up 213, so that's probably almost a little more than a third back. So we're bouncing, but not much. Bonds up 7 basis points, 386. The Bund unchanged, 218. Japan up 11 basis points, 0.88, because they were way down yesterday, as you recall. Oil up 21 cents, 73.15, still very low end. We thought it broke out of this range. No, it's not. It's back in the 73 to 82 range. It's way down the bottom end here. Brent up 19 cents, 76.49. Natural gas up a penny, but under $2, 195. RBOB unchanged, 233. Gold, which was up yesterday morning early, then got clobbered. Now it's up a little bit today. up $7, $24.51. Silver down 7 cents, $27.13. That's a real low for silver lately. Copper under $4 at $3.99. That's cheap for them as well. Foreign exchange, and here's where it all started yesterday, with the yen going way down against the dollar. The euro is unchanged at 109. The British pound is unchanged at 127. We've got the Japanese yen coming back down a little bit after being up so much yesterday. It was at 143. Now it's 145. Again, be careful because the yen is the flip side of how they determine this. Why they do that? It's 145 yen to the buck. Okay. Where the other, when I talk about the British pound, it's $1.26 for the pound is versus a dollar. So it's exactly the opposite. It takes a while to get the hang of that. Crypto up 2,064. It was down like 10 grand yesterday. So it got down under 50. Now it's 55,220. When I say crypto, I mean Bitcoin. A lot of blumbo, mumbo jumbo there, Ricardo. What are your forecast? Traffic, weather, sports, Cubs lose.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:35 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 74 degrees right now with a high of 70. Passing shower this morning. Otherwise, cloudy, windy, and cooler. Tonight will be clouds breaking and windy with a low of 65 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 95 degrees right now with a high of 110. Very warm with cloudiness. And tonight, a passing thunderstorm with a low of 85 degrees. Traffic in Chicago. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 14 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 40 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 25 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 17 minutes. Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 25 minutes. Lastly, sports. Yesterday, the MLB Diamondbacks beat the Guardians, 76. Twins beat the Cubs, 3-0. And the White Sox. Man, the White Sox. Have you been watching, yeah. Chief?
Oh, I've been watching my own.
They lose to the Athletics 5-1, making this their 21st loss in a row. That's the American League record. It's the worst losing streak since the 1988 Orioles. Today we got a couple other games. Diamondbacks play the Guardians at 5:40 p.m. Cubs play the Twins at 7:05 p.m. and the White Sox play the Athletics at 8:40 p.m. Lastly, the 2024 Summer Olympics are in session. The medal tracker states that the U.S. is leading with 79 medals, China behind with 53, and France on third place with 48. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back over to you.
Surprising that France is up because the Australians are so strong in swimming. They must not do much of anything else. Do we have Mr. Joel?
Good morning, Chief.
How are you? Did you play the bounce? You buy the dip?
Oh, gee, you know I'm the ultimate contrarian yesterday. I mean, come on. You can't sell the spoos down a couple hundred points. And, I don't know, you can't really buy it up a couple hundred points. No, it was an interesting day yesterday. You had a confluence of events that led to it. It was like the perfect storm. And you didn't even get, everyone's anticipating the Iraq starting a war with Israel. But it's just, you know, confluence of events here. Yesterday's history, it's what we do today, Chief. It's if we can hold on to these gains or calm down a little bit. But yep. Love the price action. My long-term portfolio doesn't necessarily love the price action from yesterday. But as a, you know, swing-term, intermediate-term trader or scalper, there was some fast and furious action yesterday.
What do you make of... when you start seeing a place like Japan down 12%, now they bounce back, what, 9 today or 9 or 10, so they bounce back most of the way. And you see the yen going from 163 to 143 in like 2 weeks. See that kind of a move in the currency. I mean, you know better than most how much money changes hands and currency trades every day and how a 3% move in currency is going to bury people that it didn't even know could be buried. I mean, it's just it's a huge type of thing. And they were talking all day yesterday about the carry trade. Is there something, and Ron Insano was on, one of the few people I actually listened to, was talking about, he says there needs to be something behind this. There's some bank issue somewhere or some kind of problem, because this just doesn't happen. Or at least there's a suspicion that there was, and now there isn't. What do you make of it? It's not just a regular day. I mean, come on. I mean, I don't think so. But you know, how many days do I come in here? I don't see the Japanese market down 12%. I mean, it's kind of rare, don't you think?
Yeah. I respect Ron and Sana as well. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's. I mean, first of all, that Japanese yen rally. I mean, that started back on July 11th.
Yeah, it was like 4 weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you know, and you can see the momentum in that. It, you know, we go through these periods with the, you know, with long-term capital management, the housing crisis. You know, you see these things happen, and usually, you know, someone gets taken down, right? And I can see where Ron's inferring that, but I haven't heard it yet.
I haven't either.
Yeah. So what you have to be aware of, and plus, you know, all these, a lot of these banks where, you know, they do their earnings earlier in the cycle. So I guess to his point, you know, maybe watch out for next quarter because, you know, JP, and this is just a hypothetical situation, you know, JP Morgan has a big miss and say, hey, you know, our foreign currency trading was down 87%, you know, then you got caught. So until you see, like you haven't heard, like I thought this morning that you're going to hear, you know, someone got tagged or someone got, I mean, because you're thinking about that move. But then I look at the chart of the yen and I'm like, well, man, you had a few, like this didn't start yesterday. I think it's important to note too, that, you know, you a lot of the Friday, Monday carryover, Chief, you know that,
oh, yeah.
You know, stocks end, you know, the week on a high or a low. A lot of times they have the propensity for, you know, either to fade and, you know, reverse, or you get the follow through. Well, you got the follow through Sunday night, and that was in a heartbeat. I mean, Warren dumping half of his Apple position. I mean, come on, selling into strength. That's a, you know, so it just these things just kind of snowballed with each other and got the end result of the markets. But what's important now, and I try and stress this, you know, in our show, is before you get all rah, get the pom poms out and go rah rah, this is like a generate, you know, like that low yesterday, like you missed the bottom. You need the volatility to come down. Now, you know, I'm not a big VIX guy. I more use the 9-day average range in the S&P, and it's over 100 points. It's about 115 points. That's not the recipe for us to go back up and, you know, and take out the all-time highs. Also, just throwing fuel on the fire is the U.S. political situation. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to be on either side of that. But, man, oh, man, you just, like,
well,
stack
got,
these things on top of each other, and that's what you get. You get a sell-off.
Well, you also have, a problem is that the leadership is not fixed going forward, obviously. And you've got crises basically nipping at your ass from every direction.
Yep.
But and you also have a market that most of these stocks are incredibly high levels in terms
yes.
of. So yep. you've got that going for you too. Now there are stocks that aren't. There are stocks that. But then you have people. I mean, the constant drive to make you. Man, there was some lady on last night. I didn't want to know her name but she was relentless. We expected this. This is perfectly. We've been waiting for this. So we were buyers. This is just your garden variety. What is garden variety about wars on like three fronts and an election? All this stuff going the same with massive firms trading 13 or 14 times revenue. What exactly is garden variety about this that I'm missing?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of weeds in the garden that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
I just disagree. I mean. Chief, people don't want to hear it, okay? But really what it comes down to is fundamentals. You know, the technical people, and, you know, I'm a fan of technical analysis. Everyone thinks they can, you know, they have the recipe. What it comes down to is fundamentals, and it comes down to valuations. But machines don't know about valuations, Chief. They just drive the momentum.
Oh, sure.
So a stock like NVIDIA, I mean, was that fundamentals? Was that, you know, institutions? Yeah, well, they have to participate because it's part of the index. But really, when it comes down to it, you know, if you can buy, you know, good companies at reasonable valuations, then you just have to look for, you know, you look at their earnings. And if their earnings, you know, it's PE. If their earnings don't deliver, then that PE ratio doesn't mean anything because the price is going to, you know, price is going to go down, and that's going to, you know, that's going to change the ratio. So people don't want to hear it, Chief, but it comes down to fundamentals, and We just got a little frothy up there. So when you stabilize, come back to levels.
When you look at Intel, you know what they used to call that way back when I first started? When the stock was like a 30 and all of a sudden it was 22? They used to call that the trap door. No escalator, no elevator, just the trap door. You're just down.
Yeah, yep. And I'm one of those people that have a small position in that stock. I don't know why the hell I do. But, you know, it's just kind of believing in the old guard. And that's just, you know, it's probably going to get kicked out of the Dow now. I mean, it's a mess. I mean, that another thing. Yeah, look what Intel did, especially what these other chip performances have done. You know, there was a recipe for disaster there. And, you know, also, like, you know, the weekend trades, you know, things tend to happen. So, yeah, that's my take. I just would love to see. I mean, I know we're up, man, we were up over 50. We were up 50 handles higher overnight.
Yeah.
Going over, you know, off the Japan rally. Then, we came down. I mean, there was just this. The best thing I can say is this is just a momentum market. And usually momentum markets are like, well, we got the momo to the upside or we got the momo to the downside. Man, fasten your seatbelts, folks, because we got major momentum going in both directions.
We just got Momo. We just got. Bud, take care of yourself. Next week, maybe we'll get a chance to talk a little about what's going on in the NCAA. But it seems like the market keeps driving us to the market. But that's okay.
Yeah, we don't get to talk sports much anymore. We'll do that for sure next
week. All right, Bud.
Go Blue.
We go right back to Carl.
We can go right back to Carl.
Carl, if you don't mind for a second,
yeah.
As everybody. I hate to call them head bobbers, because it's actually pretty complicated. Everybody knows that my brother, whenever I tell something at a lecture that was kind of technical, I'd say, does everybody understand what I'm talking about? And everybody bobbed their head up and down. My brother goes, they're just head bobbing. They don't know. Ask a question just to see. So, but, I mean, I want to and critique me here. Talk a little bit about all you heard about yesterday was the carry trade. Now,
right.
And actually, there's two definitions of the carry trade. This is the second one. The first one is people run essentially hedge funds that get a bonus based on how much they make, get to take a bonus, some part of the bonus becomes a capital gains if the income you made was long term or short term, which is totally insane because it's just a cash bonus to you. But that's carry trade one. All right, that's the one that Congress keeps trying to change and never can. Carry trade two is, if you start talking about borrowing where interest rates in Japan are, say, 1%, and here they're, pick a number, or 5%. Well, even guys like Carl and me could go borrow a bunch of money in Japan and invest it here and quote, make the 4%. However, when you do a currency transaction like that, which means I'm going to borrow in yen, and now I have to convert the yen to dollars. Okay, then when I convert the yen to dollars, and I'm going to do this for, say, 3 years, and I have a 4% interest rate difference, if I immediately buy a forward contract 3 years out to take my dollars back into yen, the difference in the price of the yen is going to basically be the same as the interest rate differential. Right, Carl? So you're not going to make any money.
Right.
So the trick is for me not to do that leg of the trade, right? Well, that would
right,
look
because,
so.
Well, bet, yeah, and the bet is that the currency will remain reasonably stable.
Right. But over, and Joel just said on July 11th, the yen was 106. So I'm not, if I go to Japan, I'm not borrowing dollars. I'm borrowing 163 yen.
Correct.
I'm converting it into a dollar. Now I come over here and I put it in a bank, or even a T-bill for a year at 5.5%, which they were, versus one over there. Okay, so I'm paying the Japanese bank one. And I'm getting 5.5. Yes! I mean, what could be easier? Now, however, I have to go take my dollar, and I got to pay this guy back in Japan 163 yen. And I say, okay, here's my dollar. And the guy goes, I'm only giving you 143 for that today. Well, wait a
right.
minute. Wait a minute. I owe 163. That's your tough luck, buddy.
Oops.
So now I owe another 20 yen. Where the hell am I going to get it? So
but that's always been
the
problem.
Very
with
few
trade.
People understand that, Carl. Very few.
Well,
people.
Yeah, but that's the problem with the trade. I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday, and he was asking, you know, what the blankety blank happened, right? And I explained this to him. I said, look, this is what these geniuses thought that they were going to be able to do and not have a problem with. I said, you go over to Japan, you borrow it at zero, basically, right? and then you can come over here and buy a T-bill that pays 5 1/4, right? so you do this, and this looks like free money because you didn't. And then, by the way, you can post that T-bill as good collateral for another loan.
Oh yeah,
all right, because it is as a government security, it does not have a haircut.
So actually, it's like 10%.
Yeah, but you can turn this crank almost as many times as you'd like, right? As big as your testes might be.
Yep.
The problem with this is there's no guarantee what the exchange rate's going to be in the future.
Yeah, you don't worry about that.
Well, yeah, right. And when it unwinds against you, you get it up your keister. And so this is, and the thing is it's like, and as I was explaining to her, I said, Japan has been slammed near zero rates for decades now. So this game was on in the 2006-07 time frame as well.
That's where all the money came from, for those mortgages.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But that is a big part of what blew up the world in 2008.
Anytime you leave a piece of the spread dangling, someday it gets you.
Well, it's.
I'll do the four way, but it's never going to go this way. I'll forget that third part.
Chief, how many people have sold puts?
Yeah. Well.
Okay. and worse, sold calls and then had it go skyrocket on up underneath their butt. So I mean, the thing is this kind of any time that you take a naked position somewhere, and when you're essentially short a currency, that's what you're doing.
Well, you had brokers on the floor. As a matter of fact, the guy next to me had a big handwritten button he had on his chest, no legging. The legging part, if you're trying to buy, let's pick a stock here. Let's say it's the Russell. It's 204. If I want to buy the 206, 212 call spread out 3 months, I could trade the spread, or I could just say, it looks like it's going up. I'll buy the 206s and I'll sell the 210s later. Okay. Later might work out for you. It might not.
And later might also be the end of your trading career.
Yes.
I look at this kind of thing and it's like, I were talking and I started to explain this to me. He says, oh, that's what happened? I said, yeah, that's what happened. And oh, by the way, you were a frappin' idiot if you thought this was not possible. Of course it's possible.
it's just inconvenient to think about.
Well, of course it's inconvenient because, there was your surefire thing that just went down the toilet on you.
Right, which one do you want to talk about today? Which one Friday? You want to talk about the nuclear place? And we're going to talk a little bit more about the market. And this when this starts to happen, it to me it shows like a lack of stability. It doesn't tell me that which direction necessarily, but it does tell me, and I can't, because obviously this is my business, and I don't on the show push probably hard enough about my money management business, but I tell you, Carl, it is exactly the opposite of 1981, where people were the habit for so long had been no stocks, that even though the rates started coming down pretty dramatically, you couldn't get anybody to put money in the market. And now this has been the other way so long, that the Fisher Investments, this guy, that guy, put it in the market, put it in ETFs, just let it buy and hold, don't do any sort of management, any sort of protection, any sort of even a covered call right, nothing like that. You don't do anything. It just goes straight up, and when it goes down, it's just an opportunity. It is so embedded in people.
Just buy more.
It's all in it. And the thing of it is, I'm not saying that right now today isn't a great buying opportunity. It could very well be. I don't know. The difference is between me and them is I say I don't know. That they give you investment advice right off the top. Oh no, this is going back up.
This is from my perspective, which you saw yesterday was a warning. Okay,
without a doubt.
And by the way, and Friday, okay, because it really started Friday.
Started Thursday.
Well, I mean, if you look at like the daily chart, the SPX cash, there's two huge gaps that are in that chart now.
Yeah.
Okay. And they weren't in the upside direction either. So those things tend to be magnets, at least in the short term, right? Because people get stuck off sides, and they'll sit on it until they get even, and then maybe not. Okay, So there's a psychological thing that's going on there that doesn't have anything to do with the fundamentals of anything. It's just, you know, I'm sitting there with, you know, the big hole in my balance sheet. But I think this is a warning, because these instabilities, when they get to the point that you get these kinds of moves, they're telling you something about the underlying structure.
Without a doubt.
In the economy and in the market. And what they're telling you is that you're crazy if you think that everything is fine and everything is stable.
If the prices were low and everybody was 10 times earnings, I wouldn't even worry about it. But that's not where we're at.
Well, that's right. But the problem is that's not what you have, okay? And then on top of that, you have this, you know, you have this situation that's going on with Intel and with all these other AI companies. All right, now what I believe at this point is a tempest in a teapot with Intel's 13th and 14th generation processors. There's a lot of rumbling about them getting class action sued and defects, and, you know, it reminds people that people are trying to bring out the floating point problem that Intel had, you know, 2 decades plus ago. This is not the same sort of thing at all, and as I've challenged people, I haven't gotten a single response to this, but I've challenged several people who have been screaming about this in public on it. Because what they're talking about is failures in these 13th and 14th generation CPUs that Intel's refusing to cover under warranty, and they won't issue a recall either. Intel sells two versions of these chips. One is the one that most mainline system builders build, you know, buy and use. And then there is a second one that is unlocked. And what that basically means is that you can overclock it. And the gaming kids buy them because you can run the clock rates at higher than what was specified originally by the factory. There's a risk in doing this, because when you do that, you generate more heat. And where the margins are, nobody really knows. If you find the margin the hard way, you now have a damaged processor. All right. And so what I've challenged people is, show me somebody who has had a warranty claim denied, that has had one of these failed, that has never overclocked, or it's a locked chip, and therefore they couldn't have, even if they claimed they didn't. Okay, because the problem is nobody's going to say, you know, it's like you take a turbocharged car.
Well, these claims, how much these things cost?
Well, I mean, the K series, the 14700Ks, are about $400.
So people use those things for 2 years, and something goes wrong with their computer, and they make a claim?
Well, typically if you get 2 years, no, it's, you know, these are people that are saying, you know, that 3 months ago I bought this, and, you know, and it blew up. But the problem is that thermal overload is a real thing. If you, you know, if you run something hotter than it's designed for, it's going to fail.
Did I miss a huge part of my life by not doing any of this stuff?
No, you know what? This is people trying to get the last, you know, 3%, because they're, you know, they're hardcore gaming people, and this is what they do. And I get the thing, but the problem is as chip density has gone up, and it has dramatically over the last 20 years. And you're starting to push into the limits of atomic theory. You know, the atoms are only so small, right? You can't get junctions smaller than that. As you do that, and as you pack more and more transistors into the chip, the amount of heat, the problem isn't so much that you can't pack more in there, it's that you have to get the heat out of the chip, or it melts. And so you have sensors inside there that depower and declock it when it gets close to the thermal limits, because obviously if you exceed them, you get permanent damage. The problem,
or you get a fire.
Well, it stops working when that happens, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, though, is that as the density goes up, it is possible to get an overtemp condition faster than the sensors can read it and respond to it and turn the power down.
All right, we got a couple things to talk about on Friday. I mean, problem with today, Carl, because I have to talk a little bit about customers today. The problem with today is we could have bought protection a hell of a lot cheaper last week. This VIX at
right, not now, you can't.
Not now. It's up there, and the funny part of it is the volatility is much higher in NVIDIA when it's 103 than when it's 120. You would think it would be right the other way, but it's not. Now the question is, if you were doing strategy, because I'm not going to at some point, you say, okay, the volatility is to the moon, and say XYZ stock started out at 130, and the market clocks it down to 80, all right? Now, you might, at some point here, you might be comfortable saying, and I would more comfortable in index, because the indexes don't go to zero. We keep adding stocks to make the indexes stay up. But in an index, you might say, wow, spiders are down, you know, 30%. I might get away doing a put spread rather than just own the puts, because if you do a spread, you can negate the volatility part, because you're going to buy a real expensive option, but you're going to sell a real expensive option against it. So right. you can cut some of the volatility out of...
Not all of it.
Not all of it, because it's going to be a little higher. But still, now the question is, say the spiders, what were they, 550 or something, or 540, they're down to 520. Now, are you comfortable doing a 520-480 spread, saying it's never going to go below 480? I think we're still too high for that. I mean, I do
too, and I think it's dangerous. And yes, yeah.
At some point, if it was 420, you know, we might say, you know, a $50 spread is probably, boy, that's a slippery word. That probably isn't it? Is probably good enough. But I don't think we're anywhere near that here.
But Chief, the indexes in the last couple of years have doubled.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
What makes you think that you can't trade 2,500 again?
Well, that's right. Hey, last question, because we've got to go to the professor, the other professor. What do you make of somebody coming out today and having this big buy on CrowdStrike? For God's sake, the lawsuits haven't even started yet.
Chief, I have said what I said when this whole thing started is the problem is architectural with the customers, the way they've built their networks. This is a company that should not exist except at the edges of networks, and therefore it should be a tenth of its size. Now, whether or not the market is ever going to realize that, at which point it has a tenth of its market cap, okay, I don't know. But I would never buy that company, even before this event happened, simply because it logically, the firm has no reason to exist at you know, except at one-tenth of its current size. That's its natural space. And somehow they've managed to leverage themselves into something 10 times that size. Well, that's fabulous as long as it lasts, but God help you if it ever goes away.
Yeah, but nobody's going to say we don't need it and get rid of them.
The re-architecturing ultimately will happen because it has to. This problem is not solvable in the way that they're attacking it. And how long it will take before people within the industry realize this, and I have no clue. But I'll tell you what. If we don't fix that structural problem within the way we do data processing, the problem isn't going to be something like CrowdStrike. The problem is going to be you're going to wake up in the morning and lights aren't going to work.
Well, everybody's so tied together, it's pretty scary. But yeah, but it's hard. The hardest thing to do, well, if you're in a decision making, which you were, but if you're on a board of another place, which you probably have been, if somebody walks in and says, we don't need this piece of security, or we don't need this thing we just bought. We don't need we need to go from five guards to four. And somebody goes, well, wait a minute, what's my liability as a board member if I vote for this and all of a sudden somebody is murdered tomorrow, you know, in our ballpark or something? Nobody wants that. So the idea that these guys are going to kick these guys out, say we don't need it anymore, I don't know how that happens unless somebody else comes up with something better or something.
Well, Chief, I don't know. Like I said, the problem isn't that. The problem is architectural, and eventually this is going to get solved in that way. And when it does,
well, just went up another $5 as you're talking them down.
Well, I understand that, but I'm just saying I'm not buying that, because as far as I'm concerned, that's a company that ought to be worth about 20.
Yeah, well, I think there might be a few of those out there. I just wish we knew the ones, right?
And well, when. There's a bunch of them that are out there,
More to the point, when.
Well, I don't know when the recognition comes. I'm just saying that as somebody looking at the market and as somebody who's skilled in this trade, there is no way I'd be anywhere near any of those firms.
I set the record for being early when I started the business. It took a year and a half for my bullish thoughts on the market before we rallied.
Well, there you go.
It was my first year and a half. I was 99% early at one point. I was like the White Sox.
Yeah. Well, or like the Cubs, huh?
Well, the Cubs are actually decent. I mean,
they are now. Now, come on, the curse held for an awfully long time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. They're hey, I mean, just remember Jack Brickhouse. Anybody can have a bad century.
Yeah, that's true.
S&P futures up 42. Nasdaq futures up 184. We're gonna go right to the professor, Ricardo. Or are we gonna go a quick break? Up to you, bud.
Yeah, you can go right to the professor if you want me.
Professor, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just listening to you guys.
What are you thinking? Do we know what we're talking about? Do you think did I miss anything in the explaining the carry trade?
Oh, I think I got it figured out. Yeah, I mean, you borrow currency where you get a low yield, low interest rate, then you convert that into dollars and you earn a higher yield, and then it gets squeezed if, say, for example, you did it in yen. It gets squeezed if the yen appreciates 10% against the dollar.
Yeah, then so, you got a problem. You say, yeah, we need some more yen, buddy, or some more dollars to repay this
well,
yen.
You know, unfortunately, it seems like there's carry trades all over the place. I mean, to me, they just seem like arbitrage. You know,
if you complete the transaction.
You borrow from the Fed at the interest rate on reserves rate, and then you lend to some billionaire. You know, 3%.
Or lend to us. What did Nancy say 2 weeks ago? Somebody got like their fifth credit card and borrowed $1,000 was 32%. That's a number.
Well, I mean, I guess if you could borrow on a credit card, you know, paying 20%, and then maybe get another card at 30%.
Yeah, and then lend it to somebody else at 30.
Yeah, you got net interest margin at 10 percentage points.
Did you ever read, well, it's so long ago, did you ever read the book, Arthur Haley Wheels? He did, did he do Airport? I think he did. And then he did Wheels. He did the thing about working in the
Airport, the movie with Dean Martin?
Yeah, I think he wrote that. I'm not positive. Ricardo, why don't you look and see who wrote Airport? I think it might have been. But anyway, he wrote Wheels. Arthur Haley wrote a bunch of books about different industries. And he talked about some guy there that every Wednesday, some guy borrowed $20 from him, and every Friday when he paid him $25 for like years.
Arthur Haley is the name.
Well, my mom used to do that.
What you got, Ricardo?
Arthur Haley?
Yeah.
See, my mom used to do that. When I was a dishwasher in high school making $3.35 an hour, I'd have to go on a basketball trip or something like that, or a football trip. And I wasn't going to get paid for 5 days. And my mom would always say, well, I'll give you 20 if you give me 25 on payday. 5 days!
She was a born mobster or what?
Maybe she sends her...
That's worse than a payday loan place, for God's sake, and it's your mom.
That's my mom!
No wonder you are who you are. God.
Boy, that was brutal. Man.
What happens if you miss the payment?
Yeah, I sent her goons after me.
Yeah.
Concrete galoshes.
Got it. That's unbelievable. But yeah, the guy did it. But I mean, I don't think the mob was as bad as these credit card companies.
Yeah, I don't think so, man.
It's a...
But you know, you look at these carry trades and you look at what's going on with markets. It just seems like, you know, we got one massive Rube Goldberg machine. You got all this intervention. You got the central banks doing contradictory work. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we were touching on this last Tuesday. Maybe these banks get together and create these carry trades for their friends. I don't know what's going on, because I think in a market system where you didn't have any intervention at all in these financial markets, do you think you'd have a four percentage point net interest margin on Japanese treasuries versus American treasuries? I don't know.
Well, I've never done this, but that's why you have it's still a pretty good sized pit, from what I understand, at the Board of Trade. Yeah. That's why I think most of the listeners might know, but if not, that's a euro dollar is a U.S. dollar on deposit in a European bank. Mm. Right? So there's going to be a euro dollar rate, but if you went over and said, I want to borrow a euro, okay, versus the dollar out of your bank, you're going to get a different rate. But if you get the contract, I'm going to use one of them for 2 years, and then I'm bringing it back. There's going to be the forward contract is going to include the interest rate differential. So if the, I don't know if you've ever done one of those. My stepfather used to do them. If you decide, you know, I need a euro today, and I'm going to borrow 100 euros. Okay, and I'm going to bring them back 2 years from now, and the difference between the euro rate and the dollar rate is 2%. 2 years from now, you're going to have a 4% premium to bring the thing back. Because you're not going to get the free lunch.
Yeah.
And because the bank's going to go, okay, here's the difference in interest. That's what we want. And that's the fair price of the contract plus their little, what their beak. Good, but that's why you can borrow in Europe either the dollar from a euro dollar or the euro itself.
And then you just exchange it for the dollars.
Yeah, but in Japan, you can't do that. Everything in Japan's in yen. Yeah. Well, I'm sure if you walk into a restaurant in Japan, you probably pay in dollars, I mean, because they don't, so many Americans over there. But I mean, that's different. That's not what I'm talking about. But yeah,
along the northern border of Canada, like up in northern Idaho, I remember when I was a kid working at my parents' bus station. We ran the Greyhound bus station for like a couple of years, and I remember people coming in with
Canadian coins. Life Savers?
They were exchangeable with dollar American coins.
Well, they're exchangeable because you'd love to get the American ones because they were worth more.
Yeah. But we used to take them, and the bank would accept them, and it was pretty common.
Yeah, they were a discount.
Mingle. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. But it was common for them to mingle, in the north, like Idaho, you know, Spokane, Lewiston, Idaho, whatnot.
Well, but what was the difference? I mean, sometimes it got to be like 98 cents. It didn't make any difference. Sometimes it's 82 cents. That makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but it was such a small amount. It's kind of like when people, you know, when I go to a bodega and they
Right now, the U.S. is $1.38 Canada to equal a U.S.
Yeah. I think the amount of those that were circling was so small relative to, you know, the American currency was circulating that I don't think people even paid attention to it. It's kind of like when you go to a bodega here in New York, in Brooklyn, and I have, you know, $10. And I can use my debit card, or I can use my $10 bill. But they ring me up at $10.50. The guy will just say $10. Yeah, seriously, well, that's happened to me like three or four times.
When I drove back from Canada, I went up to see had a client in Toronto to see him, and actually saw a ball game up there at the stadium. And I drove back, and I got all these Canadian, you know, bucks and change in my pocket, and I get to the last gas station, and I just walked in and dumped all my Canadian stuff on the counter and said, whatever all this is, that's how much gas I want.
Well, at least it wasn't one. What do they call the $1 Canadian dollar bill? What do they call that?
They don't call it
a loony or something?
Yeah, a loony's the Aussie.
Yeah. Well, you're lucky you didn't give him a bunch of ones, because then he would have thought you would have came from a adult entertainer.
I don't think there is a $1 Canadian. It's a coin.
Oh, it's a coin. Okay.
I think, it's a wow, but I think their first is either a two or a five.
Yeah, I think the two is called a loonie. So if you walked in with a bunch of loonies, he probably would have thought you came from an adult entertainment establishment.
Well, that's in Detroit, that's what everybody does, where it goes across the Windsor to the strip joints. I never did that, but a lot of people did that. Used to do that.
Yeah.
You go underneath the bridge, and the strip joints are all over in Windsor, right?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, they were, you know, the group here, the financial group here, you know, I'm probably speaking out of school here, but all the guys here in Chicago, I mean, we were, a lot of guys, you know, drank a lot after work and some during the day, and more the trade guys all drank during the day, but I mean, we were big on sports. I mean, people had tickets, the Cubs and the Bulls and all that stuff. And, you know, there wasn't, if you had people in from out of town, you know, you go to some nice restaurant or maybe you go to a game, there wasn't the push to go to the boob bar after in New York. There was always, when there was a bunch of people and these things, there was always a car or two. Hey, where are we going? We're going to, you know, the strip club. I never went. I mean, it was just never part of my shtick.
I mean, some guys, it was
all part of the deal.
In the Navy, it seemed like that's all my friends wanted to do, and I didn't want to do that stuff. I mean, in Thailand, my friends were going to those places and they were doing all kinds of weird things. I would just hang out at Rutt's Beer Bar. I still have her business card, and I just hang out there and play Connect Four all day long.
Well, I a couple times we did the clubs in Vegas, right? Because, of course, we run into these guys who were doing this event. All right, come on, let's go to this place. Well, it turns out the restaurant that I loved to go to, the Golden Steer at the time, has changed ownership. The owner of the place, who actually sponsored Stocks and Jocks in Vegas, and we were handing out gift certificates at the Golden Steer, which, of course, everybody loved, right, when Jen and I were on the score. And It turns out the guy owned the strip joint, the Crazy Horse 2 or whatever it was. It was only down the block. Come on, I'll take you down the strip joint. Of course, there was no cover for us. We get a table and everything. Well, it's a Friday night, and the lady goes, you better grab that table because in like 5 minutes, there's not going to be a table left till like 4 in the morning. So immediately we sit down. I'll tell you what, these guys come around us, the people show and the people I talk to. What's the most fascinating? One guy sits down, and he's got a wheelchair, right? And he's got three of his buddies, and they grab chairs over, and so we give him, yeah, sure, you can sit with us, and we all squeeze in and so forth. The guy goes, you just made your great night. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, I'm going to have girls coming by me all night long. All you got to do is watch. you don't have to do a table dance or anything. I'll just take care of it. And so it turns out the guy is in the wheelchair and is this Asian guy. And he works for Bell and Howell. And then first thing he says is, by the way, where'd you guys come from? We actually went skiing in Salt Lake. We were there for seminars. And then all of a sudden it got so hot that you couldn't ski. So we said, hey, we're only like 8 hours from Vegas, which is a long way. Plus we're bored stiff. Our next seminar is not for like 3 days. 2 days, let's drive down to Vegas. So we rent this big old car and down we go. We stop at some nice Mexican place along the way, good chow. And we're just three bumps having dinner and gambling a little bit, nothing crazy. And the guy goes, how long did it take you to get down here? I go, 8 hours. He goes, oh man, I did it in like six. Okay then. Finally I go, by the way, how did you what are you doing in the wheelchair, basically? I was more nicer than that. Well, I was riding a motorcycle like 150 and flew and did something.
Wow.
And then he goes, but I still have this need for speed. I now have this car that, the accelerator and the brake is all on the steering wheel somehow. He goes, I averaged 120 getting down here. And I'm going, wait a minute. you're in a wheelchair because you're going too fast and you made 120 miles an hour. Man, I got to go fast. I'm like, okay then.
Hagar.
The guy was kind of some huge big shot at Bell and Howell. I mean, boy,
sounds like a Sammy Hagar story when he wrote the song "I Can't Drive 55."
Yeah.
Apparently, he flew in from Paris or something. Was in upstate New York. He's driving his Lamborghini or something, and he's doing 120 on the highway. And a cop pulls him over, and he just goes, "I guess he said this. I mean, this is rumor. I can't drive effing 55, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
that's where the inspiration of the song came from.
Oh God.
Well, I'll tell you, in Portland, when I was in Portland back in the 90s, right out of the Navy, I'd go over and hang out with my friends in Portland, Oregon. And Portland's just a different place, man. It's kind of like Windsor, Canada. I remember my high school friend, Steve, and my high school and his sister's husband, Rich, they're like, hey, Hal, why don't you join us for breakfast? I'm like, sure. I was expecting like a Denny's. I walk into this place, I sit down, and the breakfast comes, and there's a girl dancing above us, completely naked.
Oh good.
While I'm eating my breakfast, I'm like,
that's too early for that.
Around going, and they're drinking like a Hefeweizen instead of orange juice.
Oh god.
It's like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, the economics of this place, and then we get off the strip story, is the girls weren't employees.
Contractors. Yeah.
Well, they depending on if it was a
they're like barbers. They're like barbers. The barbers pay. A rent, or they lease a chair for the hours, or occupying it.
Well, depending on the beers weren't expensive or anything, yeah. I mean, so it was just basically cover and a bar, but the girls, if it's a Sunday, they could just go do a shift. Now on a Friday night, they probably had to pay $75 for a shift.
Yeah.
So it was a totally different. Demand. Talk about a different.
Demand's higher on Friday night.
Yeah. Well, then, but then. They didn't care, as long as they had all kinds of them there, so they didn't care if you met somebody and the guy goes, let's go to dinner, you could go. They didn't hold you. You didn't have to spend your whole 8 hours. I mean, you do it or did wherever you want. So, but just it was kind of a fascinating view on labor law.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating because when demand's high on a Friday night, customer demand's high, the demand to be on stage is going to be high, right?
Well, this is 20 some years ago, and I think Friday was the it was a Friday or Saturday was $75 for the shift, but then Sunday night if you showed up, the guy was happy, you know, type of thing.
Well, in Pocatello, Idaho, I remember being there in the Navy, and you know, the Navy guys would hang out you know, the bars that had the best looking waitresses and bartenders.
That hasn't changed.
I dated this girl. She just kind of dropped out of college, and she was a bartender, or she was a waitress at one of these bars. And we dated for the summer, and I remember her telling me she was making $200-$300 a night.
Oh yeah.
In tips, just, you know, bringing Navy guys, drunk Navy guys, drinks all night.
Well, that'll work. The first one of these places I ever saw it was, I'll use the term, different set of rules. There was a place in the early 80s, I used to go see the Cubs spring training all the time, and there was this is long before what's the place that sold all the t-shirts all around the world? What was the name of the place? Hard Rock.
Oh, Hard Rock, okay.
Well, this there was a place called Cowboys down, and it was in this strip mall, and was in Tempe, I think. And you'd go in, and they, like, Tuesday nights, the girls couldn't get in until 9 o'clock. They had to wait outside because all the guys were in there, and special drinks for the guys, get the guys all drunk. And then the next night, it would be the girls. The guys couldn't go in until 9 o'clock because all the girls were in there, and there's half-price drinks. They had all this different stuff going on, but they had pool tables. The place was gorgeous. And they were selling T-shirts and hats. I remember, this is my view of the world. I go, who the hell would buy a T-shirt or a hat? Turns out Hard Rock made how many gazillion dollars over the next decade by selling T-shirts and hats?
Oh, yeah, they're a T-shirt company. Yeah. I mean, General Motors being a lending company.
Oh, yeah. So, but the weird part is every guy that worked as a bouncer or something, the guy looked like he was an Olympic weightlifter. And they had all these black outfits on. And every girl behind the bar was drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, whoever did. So some guy must have either got too drunk or whether he was causing some trouble. Four guys carry the guy out over their head. Who are these guys?
I got escorted out of a club in Hawaii. I was really hammered. It doesn't take much to get me hammered. Maybe two beers, you know, 5% alcohol. And this Samoan guy, he was 6'9", 6'10", and about 5 feet wide. Man, the dude was huge, just huge. He escorted me out. He was really nice.
They carried this guy out over their head.
It was huge.
It was like, you know, it was like they were carrying out a tray.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you see something like, when you get back to the market, you see something like that yesterday in the last few days, and it's seemingly, I'll say, currency unrest. And then when currencies, anyhow, a currency is not supposed to move 3% in a day. I mean, one message I can never, I know I can't get over along to the listeners because I don't, we have to get my buddy Robert from the Fed in here. The amount of currency transactions per day worldwide and the amount of money that flies back and forth is something that you can't even imagine. It's like what, almost five or six times the amount of money spent on the New York Stock Exchange every day, or in stocks. I mean, the bond market is like twice as big as the stock market. Nobody hears about it, right? But the currency market is like way bigger. I mean, every time somebody does something, you know, every time Boeing buys something from someplace, somewhere, and I mean, it's millions of dollars. It flies overseas, right?
Yeah.
And so when you see a 3% move in a currency in a day, it's like, wait a minute, somebody, unbeknownst that there even was, you know, a chance of rain, just got washed out, and somebody else is sitting there going, God, I just did pretty good on this one. How did that happen? I mean, it's a move. It's got to be equal to a 15% move in the market in terms of, because I was trying to explain yesterday, and there's no way I can do it in here, but when you talk about modeling options, when a stock has a lower implied volatility, like, you know, pick a, you know, maybe say telephone or something. A telephone's traded in 1896. Their implied volatility is probably 12, which is pretty low compared to, you know, somebody else who might be a 50. Well, that implied volatility affects the rate of change of delta, which is what your gamma, right? It's the rate. It's the second derivative of the curve. It's the rate of change of the change, right? You know more about this than me. You're the calc guy.
Yeah.
So if a stock like, say, CrowdStrike, It's trading 229.80. It's up 770. The 230 calls are going to not trade exactly 230. It must be doing this because of me. It's trading exactly 230. 230 calls are going to be a 52 delta. 50, depending on if there's a dividend or the interest rate. That, say it's 50. All right, so which means that for the next, you know, CrowdStrike moves a buck, that option's going to move 50 cents, theoretically. Okay, so then, but now when it goes from, so it goes to 231 and your option started out at $5 is now 550. That's pretty clear, all right? But now when it goes from 231 to 232, the delta in the CrowdStrike might now be 51, you know, because the thing is going to be all over the place. Where telephone, if it's trading 19 and it goes to 20, your option is going to be up, well, say to 19 and a half, the option is going to move a quarter. But now the next quarter, it might move, you know, 18 or 19 cents, because now your delta, instead of being 51 or 52, might be 80. Because at that volatility, in another dollar, it's 100, right? Where in the CrowdStrike, whether if it's a 235, the delta is probably 58 or something, because it's that volatile, it's going to go back and forth. But a currency, their volatility is normally like a 5 or a 6. So the minute it moves, it means if you had any kind of option in there, whatever, you're talking dollar for dollar after like maybe a 0.5%. So the curvature to you is dramatically different than if it's something that always moves, because the always move is priced that way. The never moves, they're priced to never move, and when they do, it hurts a lot worse. I mean, I don't know if I explained that properly, but just the conclusion, I think everybody should at least understand.
Well, I think the cause of all this chaos, it's not capitalism. It's not the free exchange of ideas, goods, and services among consenting adults. That's not what this is. This is a culmination of all the government interventions throughout the history of the United States. You know, basically starting in the early 20th century with the advent of the Fed. You have all these government interventions, and every time there's an intervention, it has consequences. So government has to fix those consequences with even more intervention. So if one intervention causes two consequences that are bad, then policymakers have to come up with two fixes. And those two fixes lead to four consequences. And that needs four fixes. And those four fixes lead to, you know, eight consequences. And you accumulate that over the history since, you know, the founding of the Fed, and you throw in that the Federal Reserve and $35 trillion in debt and $1.6 trillion annual deficits. And you have all these PhD economists trying to design this system. And it all just harkens back to what F.A. Hayek said. The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. It's just one big crazy Rubik machine. It has nothing to do with capitalism. The Federal Reserve is not a market institution. It's a price-setting organization. They set the price of money. Other central banks set the prices of their money. They create these gaps. They create these opportunities. And we're just seeing the culmination of all this wreckage that they've done. And it's gotten really bad in the last couple of years. And we've been talking about it.
Yep.
We've been talking about this for, you know, at least 2 years, how bad it's gotten in terms of policy.
Well, now, how do you, there's always going to be, I'm going to say, we got to go to break here in 3 minutes, so I'll keep this brief if I can. There's always going to be these, I'll use the term natural monopolies. When the history of railroads, by the way, if you ever want to bore the hell yourself silly, but find out the entire economic history of the U.S., all you got to do is read about the first 30 years of railroads, right, Al?
Yep.
Every dirty trick, everything is in there. But say, the way most railroads were actually constructed, somebody went to Congress, they were all federal, weren't they? I think they were.
I think the ones that went out west?
No, I mean, I think all of them were.
Yeah.
I
know the ones out west were all federal land grants, right?
I think all the ones here were too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to ask you this.
Had to use eminent domain to do that, right?
Well, except nobody lived there in a lot of the places.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But what was the first railroad? You should know this.
Something in Pennsylvania?
Very close. Chesapeake and Ohio.
Okay.
get the Ohio River or from the Chesapeake Bay. Because I mean, as the Midwest started to people started to move here, you had to be able to get goods from the Midwest, food to Chesapeake Bay. Even in Chicago, the first one was Chicago to Galena, the Galena Railroad, believe it or not, because it was a silver mines in Galena. So what they would do is they would give people, of course, there's people starting to do some farming. So they would say, okay, you get, depending on, I know the ones you're talking about, Hal, the five Western railroads got the equivalent of 20% of the U.S. property. And the idea was, actually it started before that, the I&M Canal in Chicago. The history of that, that's what connected Mississippi to Lake Michigan. That's the reason why Chicago is on the map, basically. There's nobody here, but there were some Native Americans, but not very many. They divided Chicago into square mile sections. That's why Chicago's streets are pretty much on a grid system, right? I mean, you've been to Chicago, there's a mile.
It's like Salt Lake.
Yeah, it's all on a grid system. Well, the reason why the grid system was there is they divided the place up by the grids, and they gave the people who were doing the I&M Canal, I think every other square mile or something. Hmm. Maybe it was that many. And the angle streets that you see, like Milwaukee Avenue and Elston and those kinds of streets, Archer Avenue, those are the actual Indian trails in and out of Chicago.
Wow.
So they kept the angle streets. Those were Indian trails that people used, so they couldn't say don't use them anymore. So they're in the grid. Anyway, so they were able to sell off every other one to build the canal. So it's kind of where everything did. So now all of a sudden you give somebody, you give Hal the Chicago to Galena, and oh, by the way, there's a bunch of farmers along the way. So now you're done with the railroad, and there's no roads or anything. So the farmer says, hey, there's a railroad I can get my corn to market in Chicago. There's no mystery as to why the Board of Trade opened pretty much the same year as the I&M Canal was completed, right? Because you can now bring grain into Chicago. So now you've got this system, and the farmer says, gee, how much is it to move my grain? And the railroad goes, how much you got? So there was no other way to get here, right?
Yeah.
So that's when the government started. I mean, you're probably too young for that ICC stuff back when I was younger. There was everything you shipped on railroads, no matter what it was, there was a price that the government set. The ICC books, if you walk into an ICC guy's office, his desk is just loaded with these books that are essentially a foot thick. If you wanted to send a package of grapes or a boxcar of grapes, a boxcar of this, there was a price for every single thing. It was all, because then the government said, okay, we can't let these guys, because if they're the only railroad, charge somebody $5 a bushel, it's too much, maybe $2 a bushel, to get his corn to market. And by the way, if there's a road near there, it's 50 cents. Or, because it might cost more for the 2 miles on the railroad or the little railroad to get you to the big railroad than the big railroad took it all the way to Chicago. So the government says, enough of that. We can't do that. We're going to set all these rates. And there were, so I mean, you're right in that. And all of a sudden, they decided, all right, we've got enough roads, we've got enough railroads, we're going to stop all that, and we're going to go back to regular competition, because there isn't a farmer anywhere who can't say, well, if you guys are so expensive, I can't have a truck come pick the stuff up. So at some point, they said, okay, we have enough competition, and really, that all happened in like 1973, 74 in there, and it's 75, where the airlines were deregulated, the trucking companies were deregulated, and the railroads were deregulated. It all happened kind of in the same time. And, but we haven't, and there was a reason for it when it happened, Carl. It got so bureaucratically messed up. And finally, when there was no reason for it, believe it or not, the government said there's no reason for it, and they got rid of all that stuff. But now, they don't get rid of anything, do they?
What was the last part?
They don't get rid of anything now that they don't need anymore.
Yeah.
I mean,
I would recommend a book that Murray Rothbard wrote called The Progressive Era. And he, if you're really, and I know you're really into railroads, but he has an alternative history of railroading in the United States. It's pretty fascinating. I recommend you read it, because it's like reading Milton Friedman's book about capitalism and freedom, or democracy, where, you know, he goes through all these different things like the USDA and challenges our assumptions of government agencies and what they really do, right? It challenges that history. And if you thought the Milton Friedman books were fascinating, I think you'll find this one fascinating because it goes through the progressive era starting in the late 1800s forward about, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 years. And it touches on U.S. Steel. It touches on the railroads, the cartels, and whatnot. It's really fascinating. I think, if I remember correctly, it even gets into the natural monopolies regarding electricity.
But a lot of what government did was a response to, you know, some of the crummy stuff that businesses did to people. Now, the reactions weren't maybe the best, but there's no way you could let... You just gave this guy this railroad. You're gonna let him charge whatever he wants for the rest of his life in front of people, and, you know. You can't let that happen either.
I'm telling you, if you read this book, it'll challenge that perspective that you just, you know, pointed out.
Well, I mean, if the issue with
and the reason why I think it's valid is because when government passes an act, it gives it some glowing name, and that glowing name is usually the opposite.
Oh. Without a doubt.
The effect.
The Patriot Act was essentially the Enslave Your Society Act.
exactly.
But right. I'd love to have if this guy's still alive, I'd love to have an adult beverage with him. We got a break here, but the thing sometimes I've found with, I'm going to say real economists, guys like you, you're not like that. Some of the dudes at the University of Chicago, people that had the, you know, what do you call it? They're employed for life.
Tenure?
They had a tenure and stuff. They'll sit there and say, you don't need to worry about that, railroads in 1871 screwing the farmer. Don't worry, someday it'll all work its way out. Yeah, it did in 1973. you don't give a guy a monopoly for a century and hope it all works out, right?
Well, I think tenure does give people, it creates a little bit of a moral hazard, I think. You have job protection, and it kind of gives you a license to be lazy. It's kind of like winning a Nobel Prize in economics.
Yeah, well.
You have a license to be really lazy. Everything you say is...
I wouldn't say that they're lazy. I would say that their time horizon... I mean, you and I both know that if somebody piles in and buys... If there's three hamburger places in town, and one guy buys the other two, okay, and now raises all the price of hamburgers, and there really isn't room for a fourth, you and I both, I think, know that given enough time, the guy's going to screw himself so bad that there will be room for a fourth, and somebody will come in there and somebody will do something.
What
different.
He'll do is he'll start driving around in a customized Lamborghini telling everybody, hey, there's above normal economic profits.
But I'm saying market. For... The thing that the tenured guy forgets, for two or three years, the guy's gouging people. In the long run, we're all dead, right? I mean, in the long run, it probably will fix itself, but then again, how long is it? SP Futures, now we're only up 21. As if he's only 66. Yeah, I'm no technical dude, but if we're down again today, it's not going to be good. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now. 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-388-4901.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well, North Bay Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Cardo on the board. S&P futures were leaking here a little bit. Not down, but we're starting to show like the rest of the world not up all that much. S&P futures are only up 20. They were up like 80 last night. Actually, I think they were up more than 80. NASDAQ futures are only up 58. They were up like 150 not when we started the show. Dow futures are only up 195, and almost all of that's Caterpillar, up 1120 after good earnings. Home Depot's up 292. Microsoft up 384. Pretty good bounce out of Microsoft, but still under 400. 398.99. Over in Europe, now these guys were down huge yesterday, and they're down again today. DAX down 41. They were unchanged last time we did this an hour ago, but not anymore. Down 41.2%. The FTSE down 31.4%, CAC around down 51.7. The headline was European stock markets rebound. Now it says European stock market rebound fizzles after Monday's rout. For Asia, we still got the big bounce in the Nikkei. They're closed, obviously. Up $3,200, that's 10%. They were down 12 yesterday, so they made 5/6 of it back, so pretty good there. Hang Seng, however, still down another 51, 16,647, down to 0.3%. Shanghai up 6, 28.67. Yesterday again, Dow was down 1,033 points. Ouch. S&P down 160. Nasdaq down 576. That's 3.5%. And S&P down 3%. We haven't had many 3% days like ever. Those are big days. Bonds up 5 basis points, 3.83. The Bund down 3 basis points, 2.15. Japan up 8.85. Now they were down a whole buntload yesterday because they were over 1%. I'm going to say last Friday or last Thursday. Oil, not good for oil. If you're long oil, up down 48 cents, 72.46. The Brent down 49, 75.81. Natural gas unchanged, 195. RBOB down a penny, 231. Gold was bouncing earlier, not anymore. Down $1.30, 24.43. Still pretty high, but not you know, doesn't look at all like it's heading toward 2,500 here. This is, by the way, this is the on gold, 24.43 is the December contract. The August contract's 24.03, and it goes off this week. So these guys have already pushed the December contract. Foreign exchange, we had a huge move in the yen yesterday. The yen has come back a little bit today. It's actually up. It's a little weaker today against the dollar. It's 144.67. It was 143 yesterday. Euro unchanged, 109. British pound unchanged, 127. We've got gold. Let's do crypto. Bitcoin's up 1,800. It traded under 55,000 yesterday. It's back up to 55,000. Traded under 50,000. So it's up to 55,000 today. So that's a big bounce there. Cardo, a lot of stuff. What do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:42 a.m. here in Chicago. 74 degrees right now with a high of 74. Very nice weather today. Passing shower this morning, otherwise cloudy, windy, and cooler. Tonight will be clouds breaking and windy with a low of 65 degrees. Suns of Phoenix, Arizona, 96 degrees right now with a high of 110. Very warm with variable cloudiness. A thunderstorm in spots this afternoon. Tonight will be clearing. A thunderstorm around this evening, then becoming breezy. Traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 27 minutes. 51 minutes inbound Edens from Lane Cook. You're looking at 33 minutes inbound Eisenhower from Wolf. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 27 minutes. Lastly, sports. Yesterday, the Diamondbacks beat the Guardians 7-6. Twins beat the Cubs 3-0. And the White Sox lost to the Athletics 5-1, making this the 21st loss in a row. The worst American League losing streak since the 1988 Baltimore Orioles. Today, we got a couple of games. Diamondbacks play the Guardians at 5:40 p.m. Cubs play the Twins at 7:05 p.m. And the White Sox play the Athletics at 8:40 p.m. Lastly, the 2024 Summer Olympics are in session. The medal tracker states that the U.S. is leading with 79 medals, China behind with 53, and number three is France with 48 medals. That's all I got for you, Chief.
Is Russia even there, or are the guys, are they allowed? I don't think they're allowed. Are they?
I'm pretty sure they got like blacklisted from like any major international sport event or whatever.
Can individual people though, if they do something? They can
maybe so. I don't know. I know that, for like, you know, the FIFA for like soccer and football and all that stuff. Yes, Russia is not involved in any of that anymore.
I think guys get to wear. I think they can wear the Olympic hat or something, and that there's some weird story. Here's a weird story. CENTCOM Commander General Michael Kirilla, top U.S. military commander in the Middle East, arrived in Israel today to coordinate a joint response. So evidently we're very worried about Iran and some war over there. Wait, not some war, a war. But the next quote, in the next paragraph, General Kirilla has called up atomic energy expert Hal Snar and intelligence person Mike Murphy to come and greet him over there, and he's yanking him out of the retirement pool, and says they can still do stocks and jacks from Israel. You hear this, Hal? Are you in?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm just laughing.
They want you and Mr. Mike Murphy. What the hell? What am I going to do with all you guys?
I don't. There is no way that a person in his position would want my input. I'm convinced of that. They don't want my input on that.
They might, when Mike's intelligence, they might want him back.
they don't want my. I've always been. I had the hardest time in the military saying yes, sir.
Oh God, I can only imagine.
I just couldn't do it. I've always been a contrarian. When somebody tells me to go over a hill, take the hill, I'm like thinking, well, instead of taking the hill, how about we do this instead? So I've always had a problem with authority. I don't know where it comes from.
Well, that's why your mom stiffed you $5 a week. She knew that.
Yeah. I mean, my mom doing that to me, and then my dad, hiding from the child support collectors really, really kind of in my formative years made me distrust authority. Maybe it's a mental disorder. I don't know what it is, but I have this massive distrust of authority. And that's probably why I like being a professor. Going back to the tenure thing, I think the problem with economics in general is this tenure idea, because in order to get tenure, you have to be in the PhD process, you have to become a very, very incredible expert in a very, 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 very small, tiny corner of economics. And then your success depends on you maintaining that expertise in that very, very tiny corner of economics in terms of research. And then at these big, large research universities, the most prestigious ones, teaching gets you fired. Research in that narrow, very narrow corridor is what keeps you tenured, keeps your contract being renewed every time you come up for review. And I think that's the problem with that. That's a big problem with economics, is you have these hyper experts in these very small, narrow corridors of economics, right? Like my PhD was in the 1996 welfare reform. And that's all I did for like 8 years of my career, just that. My PhD, and then my first 4 or 5 years of my teaching was I was hyper-focused on that. And I literally got bored. I get bored easily.
Well, Russell was forever on his. He was doing the show, and he was constantly, he'd work on it, get a deadline passed, and then he would do something else.
Yeah. But you're this hyper-expert in this little teeny tiny area. And when I was asked to teach macro, that's when I really started questioning these models. Was when I was teaching macro, because I was teaching micro at the same time. I'm teaching macro and I'm teaching labor, and I'm thinking, man, you can't explain a $25 trillion economy with 8 variables. You just can't do it.
No.
And these averages, these aggregates, they look nice on paper, but they ignore so much information. Like, here's a great example. When I was in Salt Lake, I'd use this example all the time. If you take the average height of NBA basketball players in the locker room, you're probably going to go, 6'7", 6'6"?
I don't know about average, but there's a lot more guys that are playing 6'1" than are 7, so I'm going to probably drop that a little bit.
My son walks in, my 10-year-old son walks in, and he pulls the average down. Now, here's the problem with averages. People will say, oh, the average is down. Well, the NBA players are still tall.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that this guy comes in who's really short that pulls the average down. And that happens with immigration. When the economy is doing well, it draws all these people from all over the world to the United States, and that pulls the average down. It pulls the overall average down, right? And when the economy goes in recession, a lot of those people will go back to their home countries, and those averages will tend to rise. And that's the problem with aggregates and averages. I mean, they call it regression analysis for a reason, because you want to kind of like get a tool that allows you to kind of like discard all these points that make up the scatter plot to get you this nice linear function. It's called regression to the line. So you basically, what regression analysis does, it expects you to ignore, commands you to ignore all this variation and regress to the mean, regress to that line. And that's the problem with this stuff. And you have to have solid economic theory to interpret these mathematical models and these statistical constructs. And if you don't, if you're just interpreting statistical diagrams, if you're looking at a correlation, you may come to the conclusion that, you know what, in order to win more games, we need to sell more hot dogs, because I have seen a correlation of hot dog sales and winning percentage, right? That's the kind of mistakes you make when it's purely statistics and there's no economic theory.
Well, I would agree with that totally. I'd probably express it differently, but you end up, there's one of the things that a lot of things people do in their previous life, obviously it happened to you because you had quite the background before you did this, but when I was at Pullman, they would always give me because I had the graduate degree, they'd do a project. They'd say, we're going to do all this. We're going to either build a building, we're going to do the railroad cars, we're going to do this. And they'd hand me the new contract with the contract, you know, with all the prices and the delivery dates, and they'd say, do, what do they call it, the analysis you do if something goes wrong.
What if analysis?
Yeah, well, it's like, that's what it is, but they'd call it something else.
Oh.
A sensitivity. Sensitivity
analysis, yeah.
And so I'd go through it, and if you have 10 variables and you screw up on any of them, if you got a little puffer built in the price, you're pretty much okay. You know, if all of a sudden, if there's a strike for 6 weeks and everything just shuts down for 6 weeks, you're probably all right. If certain parts are a little bit more expensive than you thought, you're probably all right. If the interest rates go up, you're probably all right, depending on whether they're giving you advance payments or not, those kinds of things. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into it. But what I noticed, you could take maybe a 10 or 15% hit in any one of these variables, and you're probably not ecstatic about it, but you're okay. If you take like a 2 or 3% hit in three or four of them, it compounds dramatically.
Oh, yeah.
Which isn't all that intuitive until you actually do it by hand. When I say by hand, I mean I had a calculator, but not much more than a computer. And when you see some of the models, like on risk modeling, because I talk to these guys two nights a week, we go to BAH, and they work for OCC and those kinds of places, and they're doing modeling of all, you know, everybody's portfolio. They're looking for counterparty risk. Is there going to be a day when this firm that does 90 bazillion contracts on the floor goes out of business and they can't come up with the money for another firm? You know, so I mean, it's not really counterparty risk in the sense that, you know, you have an option, we don't know who the other side is. It's not really that. It's more like contra risk more than anything else. And they keep talking about, they're these foreign dudes, and they keep talking about this model or that model, and I keep saying, guys, you know, you guys are way more model conscious than me, but it's not the model, it's all kinds of little things going at once.
Yeah.
And in my experience, I said, you know, what are you going to do when you've got all these flex options, you've got all these long-term options that people are doing? What are you going to do if the interest rate goes from 4 to 8? Normally, you don't even care about interest moving in an option model. I mean, in the short term, it doesn't matter. Interest will go from 4 to 20, and my options will expire next Wednesday. It's not going to make a bit of difference, right? But now if the option's 3 years out, all of a sudden, now you got a problem, maybe, or you got a windfall. And I said, well, you know, do you even have the ability to move all these different variables around? And they look at me like I got four heads. I said, no, you should be able to take this person's position, whoever it is, log it in someplace. You guys should have the software and say, okay, let's move the volatility 3 points and the price
5%. You're going to have much more problem doing that than moving the volatility 10 points or the stock price 10%. And they have no idea what I'm talking about, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the problem with economic models. I mean, I remember in my PhD program, we'd prove these economic theorems, right? And it was fun. It was elegant. It was beautiful. But the difference between an economic theorem and a mathematical theorem, the mathematical theorems that are really the most important are the ones with very few assumptions. The economic models have all kinds of assumptions. And ceteris paribus is the biggest problem with these economic models. Because ceteris is not paribus on my drive from home to work. Because what will happen is I'll see 15 billboards that are telling me that, hey, I can get 2-for-1 biscuits at this restaurant, or I can get 2-for-1 burritos at this restaurant. So ceteris isn't paribus. My taste and preferences are constantly shifting. And that's the problem with macro, right? Macro, there is so much ceteris is paribus embedded in these models. It makes them a problem. And that's why macroeconomics after the financial crisis was literally in the basement. Very few people saw what was coming. There were a few people that saw what was coming, and I was actually following them. I was following a guy like Peter Schiff. He was laughed out of the room on the Cavuto show by like 8 people, just laughed out of the room when he was pointing out the problems with all this intervention from the Fed and the Bush administration.
Well, the Bush administration essentially put a war on a credit card. That was a problem.
Yeah. Well, they also were encouraging people who probably shouldn't own homes. And this sounds kind of cold-hearted, but when you're a low-income person and you buy a home and you're barely able to make that mortgage payment and your air conditioner goes out or your furnace goes out, what are you going to do? You're going to pay the mortgage or you're going to fix the air conditioner? So automatically you're kind of upside down from the get-go. And he was really pushing people who probably should have been renting. He was really pushing.
There should not be that huge of a difference over a 10-year period between somebody who owned a home and somebody who rented.
It shouldn't be.
Hey, I got a question for you. We talk about economic assumptions and definitions. One of the things, I mean, a lot of it has to do with having Carl on here and over a period of time teaching me an awful lot about the labor numbers as they come out. And one thing that's changed, and boy, I can't get anybody to agree with me on this one, which is not unusual for me, oh hell. This whole definition of having a job, I mean, if you listen to the Stocks and Jacks, not, you know, every minute, but different people, and every week there's another little, you know, another little gumdrop falling that is bull. When you talk, the people on TV that have the one really nice job, okay, they're on CNBC or on Fox, I get it. They're making a bunch of dough, and they've got a job, and life is good because they've got that job. But right now they'll say, okay, we got 200,000 people who've just got a job, and obey, in my definition from when I was 15, which is a long time ago, if somebody had a job, they weren't rich, but they were okay. I mean, the job paid for, probably some rent. You had a crummy car, but you had a car. You know, that kind of, your kids could go to Catholic school at $200 a year, that kind of thing. So that was a definite, but now.
And maybe they had just one 40-hour a week job, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So, but now, I mean, Nancy last week was saying how she did a mortgage for somebody, and the guy, his hours went from 20 to 30. He was guaranteed 20, but not 40. And how many people now are 37 and a half, 35, 30, because if they end up needing them the extra day, they don't want to pay overtime. This, if you look at the establishment survey numbers we get last Friday and we get every month, it shows 2.5-3 million jobs created in the last 12 months. Okay, if you look at the household survey, that number is like 50,000. Now, without accusing everybody of being a lying sack of crap, which I don't really want to do, I'm going to say the only way those numbers can both be right, the way they're picked up, is that we now have 3 million people working a second job.
Exactly, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's assuming they're both right. Now when I talk about people that are employed, I used to think if somebody said he's making $20 an hour, that's $40,000 a year, right? You work 40 hours a week, 2,080 hours a year, right? And that's $40,000. Duh. Well, now I can't make that calculation.
Yeah.
It might be 37 hours. It might be 35. Might be 30.
Here's the other part. What kind of side hustles is he doing? Is Uber or the food delivery?
Yeah. Well,
guys doing that stuff. Is that included? Is that counted as?
Well, it is. It is in the establishment survey. It's not in a household survey.
I mean, I think in California, aren't Uber drivers considered workers? And then in other states, an Uber driver might be a contractor.
Well, you're talking about for most places, you know, I don't know the definition of this, but I'm saying if you deliver pizzas at night or you work at Home Depot at night, Home Depot is going to count it as a job.
I think
if somebody were to call the pizza place and if they're paying you something, they have to call it a job. Again, these are all the little nuances you're talking about.
Yeah.
That if we don't know the definitions of what we're reporting on, the report's kind of crummy.
Yeah, right. Maybe some guy's refereeing football or refereeing basketball. Is that counted in the employer survey?
Well, and a lot of it is.
I'm sure it's included in the household survey, right?
Well, yeah. Well, no, because the household survey.
If the person says, "Hey, I work as a referee and I get paid doing it," then he would be counted as employed.
Right,
in the household
but if somebody called the Snar household. And you're a professor during the day, and you are doing something else at night. The question is to your wife: is Hal employed? The answer is yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not yes twice. Yeah. It's yes.
Yeah.
Where in the establishment survey, they call the park district. Yeah, he's working. But that also brings to mind, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday, is the government does his birth death thing. Right. If you and I were to say. We're talking about being legit, not being, you know, dodging around or anything. If you and I all of a sudden, you say, yeah, screw New York, I'm coming to Chicago, somebody gave you a bunch of dough, chief, let's build 8 houses. It looks like there's not enough houses in Orland Park or wherever the hell we're talking about. So we get a chunk of land that can put 8 houses, we put them up there. So we hire a bunch of people. We're not paying them, you know, under the table cash. We're paying them every week, but they're contract employees. And at the end of the year, each one of these people made $50,000, these carpenters, or 60, or whatever number it is, and we're going to send in a 1099. All right, so the government's going to say, Joe here seems to be working as a carpenter, and therefore he's employed. He's counted somewhere, but not on the establishment survey, because there is no establishment, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to call us. So, you know, but I guess if you were to call his house, his wife or husband would have said, yeah, Joe's working. So he might get picked up in that survey. But at the end of the day, nobody knows that he did anything until they get the check from the guy that's attached to his 1099, right?
Yeah.
So now next year, if we can his ass, because now we're done with our 5 houses, they're not going to know he's canned either.
Yep.
So, there is this slop that somebody, I think they call it the birth and death of businesses is where they estimate all that.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean,
I don't think the response rate is all that high either. I've heard it's like around 20-30% really dropped off during the pandemic.
Well, there's no home phones.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's part of the problem, but I'm saying even if you didn't have the definitions, but you could always say, like Carl says most of the time, I think we got a dash here, but in times the economy is good, it's actually better than they say it is. If it's crummy, it's actually worse than they say it is, because nobody knows that in a good year, you and I hired these 20 people to build these houses,
yeah.
And nobody knows the next year in January if we shit can them all.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, nobody knows until the end of the year. Now, granted, they could go from our place where we just fired them and get another job the next minute. You know, I guess that could happen. But if the economy's going lousy, it's probably not going to happen, right?
Well, I think if you account for the fact that inflation's way underestimated or measured.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's on purpose.
Then when they say the economy is doing well, it's doing well for, you know, very few people. And most people are getting crushed by inflation.
It's doing well nominally, not really.
Yeah, nominally it's doing well, right? But not in real terms, not in inflation-adjusted terms.
So how, like, many, how many people
Caterpillar
were...
Caterpillar didn't beat... I mean, you got great earnings per share, but revenue's actually down year over year on Caterpillar.
So that means,
what are they doing? They're cost cutting.
No, they're not. They're raising prices.
Well, the revenue is down year over year.
Right. But I'm saying that Yeah. The revenue per item is probably up. That's why their earnings are up.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, how many places we got a dash here? How many places are you teaching? Where do I have to go to wing a tomato away from the back row?
Well, I'm in a little bit of a flux right now. There's talks of me actually moving to North Carolina, the school that I've been teaching for the last year full time. They want me to relocate to North Carolina, and so I might be doing that, or I could be teaching math and statistics at Comp Sci High in Brooklyn. So I don't know.
Well, if you go to Carolina, are you bringing the family with, or are you getting a new family?
Yeah. Yeah, the family will come with me, but man, it's getting really stressful because, you know, the school year starts earlier there, and I got to get something turned around.
I thought your wife was going to run for office.
Well, she met with an agent on Sunday, and she pitched her book. So hopefully she.
Wait, wasn't she going to run for like a committee person or something?
Well, I think, you know, with her economics degree and having some libertarian ideas like school vouchers and school freedom, I don't know if she can get elected in New York City.
She might be working up the wrong tree there. Anyway, keep us posted, buddy. We'll talk at you next week, and whatever you do, good luck. SPV is up 22, NASDAQ is up 76. We were up a lot more, but we are still up. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.